Man, I tell you, if it's one thing I love, well, if it's three things I love, it is beef, wine, and shenanigans. Ladies and gentlemen, Stephen Van Patten coming to you. As always, we do our once a week thing. Mark Abbott, as usual, salute to you there, sir. Kirk Johnson, MIA, we'll probably have to send a Sherpa out to look for him a little later. But in the meantime, let me introduce our guest, who, a woman of mystery and suspense. She writes and edits horror, dark fiction, and sci-fi up in Jersey with the help of her black cat, which is odd because mine doesn't do shit. Anyway, she's co-coordinator of the Horror Writers Association's New York chapter, and one of the usual co-hosts of Galactic Terrors, which you can catch on YouTube if you have any sense about you. Her newest volunteer job is as the HWA's chapter program co-manager, where she helps support chapters all over the U.S. She has over a dozen stories published in anthologies. A recent story, The Yellow Crown, which we're going to be talking about, is in Under Twin Suns, Alternate Histories of the Yellow Sign from Hippocampus Press. Say that three times fast. This weird historical fiction anthology, edited by the one and only James Chambers, explores the madness of Robert W. Chambers, no relation, oddly enough, classic work of weird fiction, The King in Yellow, originally from way back in 1895 when I was probably the only one around. All right, and those under the sway of the yellow sun. And she used to work for IBM. She's got an anthropology degree. She might be like the world's most interesting woman. Like we might have to like get her to selling like, what was it, Dos Equis?
Dos Equis.
Yeah, might have to have to get her some Dos Equis commercials up in here. Carol Geisander, ladies and gentlemen. Oh my God, it is.
Thank you, thank you.
Nice
to see you guys. I'm going to give you $5. I'm going to give you $5 for that introduction. Thank you.
Wow, man, thanks. I could use it.
Cool.
So, Carol, thanks for coming. We figured it'd be a good idea since the three of us, oddly enough, are featured in this rather eclectic, I want to say, anthology. And it all came together under the clandestine rule of Mr. James Chambers, our dear friend. And it was funny because Mark and I both had the same experience, and I imagine you might have too, and you can get into this, where it's like you get contacted by James, but it's under like some blanket secrecy thing. Don't
keep it under wraps.
You know, just keep it under wraps. And you're like, oh, okay, all right, okay, secrets, whatever, I got you, Jim. You know, I'm good to keep my mouth shut. And then the book comes out, and for me, the first name I see, Mark Abbott. And I'm like, but you know, Mark and I talk almost every goddamn day. How you actually, first of all, the fact that he trusted us both to keep it quiet. The fact that we both kept it quiet.
The fact that you did is amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, like we literally were like, motherfucker, you in the book. Yeah, it was like that kind of thing. It was hysterical. And it's great that we both got to, you know, be a part of this. You are also a very significant part. You have a great story in there, actually. It was actually one of the first ones I read.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, we're friends, so, you know, obviously I'm going to read yours first. I mean, you know.
I read your guys first as well, so, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So, was your experience being recruited, was that more or less what you experienced?
Yeah, it's the same thing. I mean, how delightfully wonderful to be invited into an anthology with Hippocampus Press. I mean, yeah, that's pretty cool. I have to say, I was not really familiar with the work that we were going to be writing about, but there you go. That doesn't matter. I can do anything, right?
Yes.
Given time and you know, and that extra cup of coffee. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Talk about it.
Yeah. No, but it was way cool. I had a lot of fun. I do some things like this for the small press that I work with, where we do things based on a classic work. So I kind of enjoy doing it. I don't know if you guys like that kind of work as well. Take something and then shift it and do something different, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the way James, the Repara story, and what he told me was, he said, I want you to stick to the year that the story takes place in and find some historical, like interweave something historical in it. And I'm looking at this thing, I'm like, all right, what? So that's why in my story, out of nowhere, I pick up Jacob Reese, who those of us who live in Brooklyn know Reese Beach. And then now I know who Jacob Reese is, other than the name of a beach here in New York. And then I'm trying to figure out, well, how do I know nothing about this time period in New York City. I think, which was the fun part of having to do so much research about that area of New York. And then it just went from there. It was just a matter of figuring out, trying to understand that story and, you know, how maddening it was, because I had to read it twice, because the first time I didn't realize the guy was crazy. And then the second time I'm like, oh, okay, now I see, now I see where I want to go with this. And
I did the same, yeah.
And I was pretty excited about doing, because again, you know, he swore me to secrecy, and I don't know why I thought, I wasn't thinking anybody else in the HWA was going to be approached. I'm just sitting there thinking like, I'm going to be in a book that nobody knows about, and I got to keep my mouth shut.
And, yes, we and did so well.
To be honest, I think it was the last week when I think all the stories needed to begin. We were finishing up a show, and Steven goes, yeah, I got to get ready to go because I got to finish this thing for James. And I'm like, and it clicked. I was like, wait. And I didn't say anything. I'm like, no, he can't be doing the same. There's no, and then the book comes out and I'm like, Stephen Van Patten. This guy just caught all of us.
It's cool. You know, I have an idea. Since I didn't know a whole lot about Robert Chambers and his stories when I got recruited to do this, how about, let's just tell a little bit about what this is. So Robert Chambers was a guy who wrote in 1895, and he wrote four main stories that are in this King in Yellow mythos. And he was actually an influence on Lovecraft, who wrote after him. But so Jim told us to pick two of those two stories that he mentioned, the Repairer of Reputations. And if I wasn't here online, I would tell you exactly what the other one was, but my mind just went blank. It's the other one about the art student, the artist in, I can't remember the name of the other story. Anyway, so he said, do some sort of a story based on these two works. And in the Repairer of Reputations, the guy is actually, he's insane, is what you can imagine. And he's imagining all these things in 1920s Manhattan that are his interpretation of things. And one of the things that I think was significantly called out by, you know, your story, Mark, and a touch in yours, Stephen, as well, was the subway stations were considered by him to be suicide bunkers. And that's where you go to commit suicide. And, you know, they would see people come in and not come out. Well, of course, they're dead. So he was doing all sorts of crazy stuff in an attempt to take over the world. And he drew in this guy, Mr. Wilde, who also features in Mark's story, who was actually a repairer of reputations. He would go out and fix up somebody's reputation that had been ruined, which I found just fascinating, considering that we have that issue today. Your reputation can go like that for one thing you say on a Beef, Wine, and Shenanigans. No. So, and then the other story had to do with seeing the yellow sign. That's what it was. Have you found the yellow sign? Have you found the yellow sign? And the whole gist of it was, there's this play, The King in Yellow. And if you read the second act, You go insane.
Go bananas. You go crazy.
So it's just so clever to make a whole world like that. I just think it was really amazing, you know.
Yeah, it was definitely like the earliest example, one of the earliest examples outside of, I don't know, Greek mythology and the Bible, maybe. It was in terms of like real complex world building, you know. And it, I had kind of skimmed it like years ago. So when James kind of approached me about it, I was like, well, I have it laying around the house somewhere. So then I went and I found it, and he sent me some more specific stuff that he wanted me to concentrate on. And then it's funny because I zeroed right into like the racism that's kind of implied in there a little bit.
I'm sorry, do you want to see my surprised face? Or no? No, it's such a great story.
Thank you. But what's interesting about that also is that that was around a time that I was doing a lot of episodes for the YouTube channel Extra Credit, Extra History. And I had already been so deep down this Black history rabbit hole with all this horrible stuff that happened to the Harlem Hellfighters, Medgar Evers. And also got to remember, this was also in the middle of COVID. I want to say like sort of the height of COVID, you know, and we're all kind of like dealing with all that. I can honestly say I was not in a great place, if I can be completely honest. So, I think a lot of that came gushing out into my story quite a bit, you know, and I'm happy with the finished product and everything, but I also, as I'm reading everybody else's stories, I'm kind of in sort of like a self-critical manner. I'm kind of looking at it like I may have drifted a little further away than everybody else, but I mean, I got to finish reading everybody's story in order to like, you know,
there's
to make
so many great stories.
Yeah. But they're all, the thing is, they're all great. And I completely meant what I said on Facebook, because I'm about halfway, maybe three quarters of the way done, or halfway done, something like that. But, you know, it's like everyone I've read so far could be an episode of The Twilight Zone and be a good standout episode. So, you know, I have not been disappointed yet. You know, Megan's, Patrick's, you know, the bunch that I've finished so far, I mean, just like, whoa, like everybody, and probably just because we love James so much and we respect him so much, it's like, and everybody just kind of like snapped too. It's like, all right, we're going to do this. And it's like, and everybody, I think everybody kind of like had that mentality. Like you got that phone call and it was like, all right, you know, Avengers Assemble, basically, you know? At least that's my take on it.
No, I started going linearly through the book and then stopped and then just started hopping around a little bit just so that I could get an opportunity to read. Because where I was like, I wasn't going to get to you guys' story anytime soon. And I was like, all right, you know what? There's no thing in the cosmos that says I have to read these stories in order. I can just pop around the book and just go around them. And yeah, every time I've picked up a different story, I found myself glued to it. Like I'm like, I must finish this to find out what happens. And it's just an amazing collection of work. I think everybody, there's not a story in there that I think anybody didn't take seriously. You know, it wasn't sort of like, oh, this is just a thing to do. And, you know, another notch in my belt to take down Publishing Lane. I think everybody went in there, you know, wanting to put their best, as you know, out there and leave it on the table and walk away and then, you know, have other people truly enjoy it. And now after the release of the book, I've seen so many people on Twitter and Facebook who I did not even know who were huge fans of The King in Yellow. And I've seen people take pictures of their library where they have all the books, and now Under Twin Suns is sitting on their table, and I'm like, wow, this is, you know, cool. You learn about all of these different. There's so many authors who are writing, who have written speculative fiction that we didn't know wrote speculative fiction.
Yeah.
Or it's something that we just never came across. And, you know, it's refreshing to have new material to look at and to go down. Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So Carol, when you're not dazzling us with short stories and Under Twin Suns, let's talk about some of your other stuff.
My other stuff.
Yeah, because you've got some anthologies and all kinds of, like, so the Cat Lady thing. Let's talk about that for a second, because you know, I as Cat Men, or well, Mark, mm-hmm. Kirk has like a whole pride in his house. you know, and you have where's the baby?
All right, I'm gonna do this. This won't show up when people are listening, but there she is, right there.
Oh, see, yeah. Yours, yeah, you told the truth. Yours just kind of hangs out next to you.
Yeah, she's Velcro girl.
Yeah, you know? Mine, you know, she's hungry. You know, she'll make her.
She just comes over and yells at you. I know.
That's exactly. Well, you've been on enough Zoom calls with me to know. Yeah, exactly. So basically, she really wants to be obnoxious. She'll just walk right across the screen.
Yeah. Well, it's not a real online segment until you see a cat, you know. So now you guys are official because I showed my cat here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the anthology is called Cat Ladies of the Apocalypse. Mm-hmm. And I saw this call online and I went, oh, that sounds wonderful. So I wrote a story, which is very cool. It's called Runt of the Litter. And basically all these stories had to have two things. It had to have a cat and an apocalypse and a lady. Oh, wait, that's three. Okay. So I made a story about a traveling midwife after the some sort of apocalypse has happened and society has gone down the tubes, and she's going from wilderness site to wilderness site. And she has a cat, a Maine Coon cat that travels with her. And, you know, what we all figured for this anthology was pretty darn cool because, you know, you think of The Road by Cormac McCarthy or any of those books, there's this cool dude after the apocalypse and he's walking down the road and he's got like a dog usually. We're like, nah, we're going to do this different, you know? So yeah. We've got women with cats and it's the same thing. You know, each of the stories in that anthology is totally different and wacky and fabulous, you know, way cool, you know. So you go from one to the next, it's like everybody was given the same idea, you know, and did something different with it. So that's kind of cool.
That is cool when that works out like that. Yeah. And we've all participated in April Gray's anthologies, so shout out to her.
Oh hell.
Yeah. You got a favorite from the April Gray batch?
Me, I'm in Hell's Mall and Hell's Highway. Mm-hmm. And I really like my Hell's Highway story because it starts out fine and it gets nasty at the end. So
yeah. Mark. So we've been at this horror writing thing for a while. Mm-hmm. So I gotta tell you, Carol, among her many other things, she does make a great MC, doesn't she?
She does. She, Galactic Terrors is, you and Jim do one heck of a job. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's not, you know, the great thing is that the two of you are doing this online. You're not even in the same room to kind of feed off of each other's energy. Usually when you have two hosts, you know, one has to feed off the other, you know, they both feed off of each other to get that energy. You guys are absolutely fantastic. And your hosting is phenomenal. You know, you really get in there with the authors. I love the Q&A sessions because, and the couple of times I've done it, it's been a lot of fun to, do the Q&A and talk to people and explain the method to the madness
and what's behind all that. So Galactic Terrors is a monthly horror reading. It's horror, kind of sci-fi kind of stuff. Doesn't have to be strictly horror, But weird stuff is good. And we go on the second Thursday of the month at 8 o'clock Eastern, and people can look at hwany.org for more information. That's the easiest thing to say rather than trying to babble some Facebook event. But yeah, what we used to do, that's how I met you guys the very first time, was at a reading from HWA New York. Mm-hmm. At Lovecraft Bar. And we used to do these things in person. And then, of course, the pandemic hit and we couldn't. And you know, a lot of people went online with such. And so we saw a lot of different readings. I was watching a lot of the mystery, like noir at the bar kind of readings and such. And Jim and I started talking about it. And we said, let's try and do something. So, you know, a good bit of research later. And we picked StreamYard to do our podcast, our broadcast through, and Jim and I learned it in a hurry. And I swear, the first night we were doing it, we 20 minutes beforehand, we weren't sure we were actually going to be able to work it, you know, because the thing had not rendered correctly to broadcast it to YouTube. So we're like, I hope this works, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, but no, you guys have done an amazing job with that.
Thank you.
And that was the thing. It's like, All these organizations and everybody, like especially writing organizations, like everybody kind of took a hit once this whole thing started, and conventions, of course, had to go away, and you know, so you can't really. It's like you had to pivot, you know. And I'm happy to say that the Horror Writers Association, we definitely did.
Yeah.
You know, and mainly because of you and Jim and Lou. Lou.
Yeah, I started making those little videos for the intro, because you know, we said, well, let's do something different from what the other shows are doing. So I made like little still pictures with little music, just we'd have 10 seconds, you know, to swap the screens, because Jim had to figure out how to do that live the first time, you know. Mm-hmm. And then Lou came on. Thank goodness Lou came on, because he's got a great background in film. Lou Rera makes these really cool 15-second intros now, and they're so spooky and cool, you know. But, you know, actually, one of the things you mentioned had a lot to do with how we decided to work this. The idea that we were all isolated in the pandemic and not seeing people at a convention. And one of the greatest things about going to a writer's convention is hanging out in the hall, hanging out in the lobby, hanging out in the bar and talking to people. So that's why we decided to do Q&A for each person afterward, because that was missing. You know, so we said, well, let's at least give somebody some conversation that they can watch and people can chat, as you know, in the YouTube chat. And I think that really helped us out. But it's so funny because when people come up, you know, we decide ahead of time who's going to interview which person, you know, sometimes 10 minutes before the show. But that's fine because we have no idea what we're going to ask the people. And no idea, you know. Yeah, we're familiar with their work and such, but a lot of the
time we're all pals, but at the same time it's like
we also have guests come in from you know the broader HWA community and horror writing community. So those folks we may pay a little more attention about what we're going to say. But what I really love to do is react to whatever it was they just read and talk to them about it. It's like, oh my god, I loved how you used the presence of this, you know, Canadian wilderness as one of the characters in your story. You know, that kind of thing. So it's really been fun. And we've had 12 shows. So our one coming up in August is our we're going to call it our anniversary show, because, you know, that's our year is done. And I'm kind of excited. We've had Mark on a couple times. Stephen, we've had you on to read. We also have Mr. SVP here coming on as our guest host this fall, which will be very cool.
Jim
and I are each going to be taking a month to read. And so when I'm reading in September, Megan R. Curry is going to be the guest host. And that's good because I will actually be broadcasting from a hotel on the night before a convention.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. And then the following month it's October. Yes. That's Jim is going to read and Stephen's going to be Jim. But you don't have to do all the thing where you pull all the levers and the buttons behind the screens to run the StreamYard. I think Jim will still do that part. So
basically, folks, what's going to happen is Carol's going to drive. I'm going to be drunk. And
I can't wait.
I mean,
and Jim's going to park the car.
And that's it. I fully intend to act up. I'm just gonna put that out there now.
No, you're gonna make me do my surprise face again, aren't you? Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit. The surprise face, though. I get a kick out of that. It means I did something funny, you know. It's like,
yeah, it's fun.
It's fun. Come on, SPP.
Yeah. I need to tell you guys something. Now that we're talking about HWA and readings and things like that, I met you guys at a reading that I came to attend. I met Teal James Glenn first because we were at a local heliosphere convention and we both read stories and sold books next to each other. And he said, I'm doing a reading. I said, oh, I'll come listen. I never wrote any horror before that. I was writing science fiction and you know, dark cyberpunk stuff. So I came to this meeting and it happened to be a meeting he was reading and you guys were showing some of your videos that you'd made at this meeting in Lovecraft, you know? So I think, Mark, you made the video and Steven, you were the vampire in the subway, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I'm like, this is so damn cool. All right. I want to do this. So.
Oh yeah, being followed. My Mark Abbott acting debut. I mean, I've been in a couple of little things, but this is the first time working with the great Mark Abbott. Having him direct. Actually, I got to be honest. Just being responsible for being a vampire in the subway might have been one of the most easiest mornings of my life. I think the only crazy part about that was, of course, I had like fangs and contact lenses, and I got in an Uber. And dude didn't really. I don't even know if he noticed. And I wore shades, so I was like, I don't want to freak this dude out.
But you left the teeth in?
The teeth were in.
Yeah.
Okay.
The teeth were in. Like Mark knows. He was right there when I got out of the cab, and he was like, "Dude, didn't notice." Like, no, it's all good. Let's go. But yeah, I came in full on, you know, ready to be, you know, because you know, time is money, man. You're shooting, time is money. I know that from being a stage manager. It's
like, right. You run the show.
You want to hear? Oh, the guest is here, and they're already ready. They don't need to go to makeup. Mm-hmm. They don't need any. You want to hear that. When you're shooting stuff, so you know I was trying to be cooperative. You know, I hear he's a little temperamental when you know the actors, you know, don't. Mark's fine.
Well, you know it's funny. You know it's funny when so we just that day we shot that piece. The film gods were on our side because that particular train station that we shot in. I picked it because it had this really great long hallway, but there was a steep step that in my mind, I had this whole scene with how Steven was going to come start up at the bottom of the stairs and the girl was going to be running. And each time she looked back, he was much closer each time. And then we get to the train station and it's closed. Like we couldn't go through the turnstile, but the hallway is empty. There's nobody coming through there. Yeah. So we had no problems with foot traffic, people interrupting us. We were able to shoot that entire thing. And I keep thinking that somewhere in the MTA, that little camera that sits above the turnstile, someone was sitting there just like, yo, this is really good. What is that guy supposed to be?
He looks familiar. Isn't he an author? Wait a minute. Yeah. Oh, and, that's a riot. What time was it?
Oh, that was like early on the Saturday morning. Oh. It was an early, it was a weekend when we did it.
It was definitely a weekend.
Probably like around 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was like 2 in the morning. I seriously did.
No. We did that. And the funny thing was just how as writers we do things without like subliminally, I don't know how many times you come up with an idea, you go on to the movies and you see your idea right there on the screen and you're like, you gotta be kidding me. Okay. Somebody else came up with this. So we shoot this thing and I edit it. And about a week later, I'm on a Hammer kick. So I just start watching all these Hammer movies and I get to Dracula 1972 AD, which I have not seen since I was a kid. And the fight between Van Helsing and Dracula starts, and Dracula knocks him over, and he goes reaching for a bottle of holy water, pulls it out, swings around, throws it in Dracula's face. Dracula like throws his hands up and he pushes him back onto like some spikes. And I'm sitting there going, wait a minute. I just did that. It's like, but I remember this in this movie. And I'm like, oh my God, my mind must have remembered it somewhere. And I'm thinking, I was like, I've come up with this cool idea with a guy walking around with the bottle of holy water the whole time. And here we go, Hammer beat me to it almost the year I was born.
All right, now I have an alternative theory. That scene was not actually in the movie until you made yours, and then it appeared. See, that's what happened.
Well,
strangest things ever.
And Mark, also got to remember, Dracula, his ultimate death is brought on, if I'm not mistaken, by the stagecoach wheel.
Yeah. Yeah. Like in the beginning. Yeah. So it's.
So yeah. You didn't kill me with a stagecoach wheel. So, I mean, you really didn't copy anything. Cause you know, I mean, granted that would have been a little strange. What is a stagecoach wheel doing down here on High Street? But,
Or if we just commandeered one from Central Park.
Right.
Could have done that.
Paid him for an hour. Yeah.
Some driver comes by. He's like, "Where's my horse and carriage? All right, we got to get this shot done. Get the horse back before anybody notices.
Wow.
Oh, we would have been some arrested. Oh my God.
So, Carol,
like
I have a question.
Before being a horse thief, no less.
There it is. Carol, I have a question.
Sir.
Because you said you started out with science fiction. So, what was your draw into science fiction? Because we always talk about all of us having these, what inspired us to get into horror and stuff like that. But what was your draw into the science fiction realm?
Well, when I was a kid, we moved a lot, and every year or so, I was either changing schools or changing towns or both. And so, when you move over the summer, what are you going to do? You're going to sit around and read. So I used to consume a book or two a day. You know, and I read science fiction and Andre Norton and Isaac Asimov and all that stuff. So I read all that. And then over the years when I was commuting, I'd buy all the little, science fiction, the Asimov's magazine and things like that, because they're convenient to carry when you're traveling on commuting. And something funny happened, though. I wrote a cozy mystery first, which turned out not to be a cozy mystery. Apparently they don't scoop out eyeballs in cozy mysteries. Who knew? All right. So yeah. But I was in a group called Writer Punk, a Facebook group. And it had to do with steampunk and biopunk and cyberpunk and all that and stuff. It was fun. And one guy said, actually, you know, it'd be really cool if we did, you know, like a steampunk or a diesel punk version of Hamlet or, you know, some other Shakespeare play. And everybody's like, oh yeah, that's great. And I'm like, dibs on Macbeth, right? So we're all talking about it. Nothing happens until Jeffrey Cook puts a stake in the sand and says, deadline, dudes, you know, get this in by this date and we'll make an anthology. So we did, you know, I wrote a cyberpunk version of Macbeth and we made an anthology of it and we got, you know, a wee little bit of attention. And then we made another one and then we did some more anthologies. And at that point, you know, we worked from being a cooperative to, you know, a cooperative is a great idea where everybody does something, but still somebody has to be kind of guiding the ship. So I took over as the editor in chief of a wonderful team of volunteers. And so we've had 5 anthologies out now and they're all charity anthologies that we pay for. We support a no-kill animal shelter out on the West Coast called Paws, and we pay for 2 big dog kennel cages for the whole year, every year, which is, you know, kind of cool with these anthologies.
That's pretty awesome, yeah.
Yeah, so our latest one is coming out over the summer. It's called Taught by Time, Myth Goes Punk, and so that's myth and folklore and such. So that was what I was originally doing, but cyberpunk itself is usually pretty dark. You know, the whole idea with cyberpunk is, you know, the corporations have taken over, the common man has got nothing, and they're ground under the heel of the man, basically, right? And even if the common man tries to do something to better his lot, it doesn't usually turn out right. You know, he usually winds up worse. So that's kind of a dark view of things. And it wasn't that big of a jump to go into horror from there.
Mm-hmm. I guess not. That's wild. Did I read somewhere that you were an Agatha Christie enthusiast?
I was saying those summers where I read all the time. Mm-hmm. Well, my mom had all of them. And so we read all of the Agatha Christies and went through them all. And that's why I originally started out with a mystery and all. But it was funny as a kid reading them, because after a while, you know, you've read all the books. It's like, let me read another one. I would get halfway through reading it the second time. It's like, I remember now. Okay, I remember what happened. So I think it's got, you have to wait at least 10 years before you reread Agatha Christie. Otherwise, you figure it out.
Right. Yeah. I think I was like that with Stephen King. I would sometimes go back.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, because, and of course, the other thing is I was reading Stephen King when I had no business reading Stephen King, really.
Probably.
You know, when you're 12, you know, I distinctly remember taking an English test and finishing the English test before everybody else. English test is on the desk, and you know, of course, the teacher's like, all right, if you're done with the test, you can sit there, read quietly or whatever. So I'm sitting there with The Shining, and she's walking by, making sure people aren't cheating, and then she stops, and then she kind of like moonwalks back, and she's like, what are you reading? And I hold it up like, it's The Shining. You never heard of The Shining? You know, like, what's the matter with you? It's like, you're an English teacher. Like, what's your
Why
problem?
Don't you know this?
Yeah. Right, yeah. Like she's the idiot, you know? And she's like, you understand it? Now, what I probably should have said is, well, I'm 12, so there's probably a couple of things going over my head, but I get the basic gist of it. You know, the guy's crazy, and the house is, you know, got, you know, demons or something in it. Yeah, I got that part. Like, you know, what's the matter? You know, you've seen the grades, you know, like, what you think? You know? and then as a reward, and the test was over, she started talking about that to the class, and then I had a fight at 3 o'clock, because, see, when you're when you're a little skinny little black kid, and your teacher decides they're going to make an example out of you.
Oh, no.
For doing some nerdy shit. You might as well just get your date planner out, because somebody is trying to schedule a 3 o'clock meeting. You know, and it's a little more than a meeting. It's like, all right, so let's see. Rudy wants me Tuesday. 6-0 wants to fight Wednesday. You know, it's like that kind of thing. So it's just like, oh, God. Mm-hmm. I don't miss junior high school at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I get to kill people named after my old classmates in the books. So there it kind of works out.
I had a playground encounter of my own in fourth grade. There was a boy who was picking on me and wouldn't stop. And so I finally said, oh, yeah, meet me so-and-so on the playground. He didn't show up.
Ah, Carol Gangsta! Carol Gangsta Cousin!
Yeah, if somebody finally clued me in that he liked me, which is why he was picking on me. It's like, yeah. I had no clue. What do I know?
Yeah,
I was like 9, 8, whatever.
Yeah, when it's someone of the opposite sex, you know, that's probably what it is, you know.
Yeah.
Those appointments I had nothing to do with anybody liking me, but.
I had an experience with reading something before my years as well, reading all these science fiction books. John Norman wrote a whole series of books that took place on an alternate planet called Gore, which was on the opposite side of the sun from the earth. And it was a very different kind of world than here. And I was reading the books and my dad was reading them with me. And so I was 11 or 12, I think. We went down to my grandparents for a vacation in Florida. I have nothing to do but read these books. So I got way ahead of my dad. And he suddenly looked up and realized I was in like book 5 or 6, which is called Slave Girl of Gore. And when he got to that, he's like, I think we're done with this series now.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh. Mm. See, and I guess it's funny because, you know, my mother had a lot of stuff laying around, but she would never finish the book. And then I'd finish the book. So I would be the one ending up knowing a little more than she did, you know, which, of course, you know, in a roundabout way, that all leads to my story that I tell all, you know, all the time about, you know, me begging my mother and my aunt to take me to see The Shining when I was, you know, relatively too young to be going to R-rated movies by myself. You know, but I also was going, you know, with the thought that Scatman Crothers' character was going to be saving the day. And of course, you know, as a grown, and talk about things going over your head because you're a little kid. Like, you know, had I, you know, the cynical entertainment professional that I am now would have saw Scatman Crothers being cast as the hero of a movie and been like, well, he's a nice guy, but obviously this we're about to experience an okey-doke here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what it was. And, you know, you got these two older black women who were raised in Alabama, and the last thing they really wanted to watch was Scatman Crothers take an axe in the chest. Mm-hmm. But, you know.
If I recall, they didn't want to talk to you all the way home, right?
Yes, that is correct. Well, there was initial silent treatment, and then there was sort of what I like to call giving me the blues the rest of the way home. So it was like, the boy got us in the theater watching this. Yes, like, oh, Lord. So luckily I eventually grew facial hair, so I was able to get into R-rated movies on my own. And, you know, so I got to make my bad choices by myself.
I had
Did you get in trouble for reading stuff?
Reading and writing. The writing, well, because, you know, growing up, my mind was all over the place. I don't want to say I didn't like school. It's just that I just didn't like what was being taught. So I had, you know, those black composition notebooks and teacher would be talking and I'm writing short stories. I'm just off in a completely different world and got it confiscated and open school night comes and we're sitting there and, you know, they're going through your son, you know, Mark is not doing this, that, the other thing. And on top of that, they went in the drawer and took up, boom, he's over here writing the great American novel. And my father's like, what? He said, yeah, apparently he's in the back of the room here writing away. And it's like 20 pages of a short story. And he's like, what is this? And I'm like, it's just stuff. Nothing interests me. I don't like the. And then that same teacher later on that year,
Napoleon, you know, basically,
calls my parents up, calls my mom because my mom was in the school system. It's like, I need you to come up to the school. So he goes, so this is what your son is reading when he's supposed to be doing social studies, and drops a copy of Jay Anderson's The Amityville Horror. And my mother's like, okay, first of all, where'd you get this? And I was like, it's on the shelf in the basement. I got it from reading. I got it from watching you read it. You know,
your name in the front. Yeah.
Like, exactly. Whose book is this? Property of. So, and she's like, why are you reading the Amityville Horror when you should be reading? I'm like, because none of that stuff's interesting. This is interesting. And then, it was that one and their copy of The Exorcist, which my father had to conveniently try to find and hide from me because he was like, you're not, because it came up, because what happened was the year it came on CBS. And I always tell, like, Steven, I always tell the story about how my father loved horror, like, but he liked Hammer, Universal. Once we got past Psycho, he was like, yeah, I'm not doing zombies and the slashers and all this other stuff. But apparently he and my mother went to see The Exorcist when it came out, and it scared him it scared him to the point where he left the theater and didn't come back. And my mother was left sitting there by herself in the middle of this movie, because back then, you know, the men could, you go out into the lobby and smoke. And she said he told her he was going to have a cigarette. And she said after a while, the dry, you know, the iconic scene, the exorcist shows up. And she's like, well, where the devil is he? Because this is about, it's about to go down.
Where
and
the devil is here. Yeah.
Well, so she goes out in the lobby, and there he is with 10 other guys. And they're all who have now been frightened out of their minds and refused to go back inside. So when CBS announced, you know, CBS, they had that one guy. He had that voice, The Exorcist, Sunday at 8 o'clock. You know, and it's just like, and I'm like, oh, because all they would show was him getting out of the car, her opening the door, his silhouette, and a crack in the ceiling. And then you would hear Reagan's voice, and then it's just like The Exorcist. And this was my parents, like The Exorcist. My mother to my father, you know, The Exorcist is coming on Sunday. And I'm like, what's The Exorcist about? She's like, it's about, and this was my mother's explaining, it's about a girl being possessed by the devil. Oh, hell, I gotta watch this. And she, no, you're not watching that. She's like, you're not watching The Exorcist.
How old were you, do you think?
Oh my God, that was like late, that had to be 79, 80.
Yeah.
It was right. And my father goes, she goes, Milton, what do you think? He shouldn't be watching something like that. And he's like, no, he's not going to watch that. And then my mother, 2 seconds later, remember when her head turned completely around? I'm like, you can't say that in front of a kid. And then turn around like, you can't watch this. I'm
and
like,
then, right. And then be mad when I'm sneaking around, trying some ninja shit so I can watch this damn thing.
That was me in our house on the second floor. So my room was down the hall from my parents, but there was like a little alcove that I could stand in the dark. And that's what I did. I stood in the dark listening to The Exorcist and then having to play the movie in my head to try to figure out what's going on. And then every so couple of minutes, I would walk into their room and just so that I could glance at the TV to see, to now know what the characters look like, and then go back and stand in the hallway and try and picture.
So you
can
make the movie in your head, yeah.
Make the movie in my head.
That's and awesome. It's like, that's what started the writing.
Yeah.
Okay, I've got one. Little Shop of Horrors, the original movie with a black and white, you know, way back when.
Yeah. Roger Corman, yes.
Yes, so when I was a kid, I was maybe six, maybe seven, you know, it would come on really late at night, right? So my parents put me to bed, and then they woke me up at like midnight to get up and watch this movie with them, because they had seen it before, they thought it was great. So I'm like six or seven watching Little Shop of Horrors in the middle of the night in my footy pajamas, right? You know, watching this thing, and it's like, this is really weird. This is cool. Okay.
Were you scared?
I don't think so.
Right.
I don't know.
Because I mean, it wasn't. I mean, yeah. Like, I guess that older version, it wasn't that graphic.
No, it was more weird than scary.
The flowers
at the end
with the people's faces on.
Yeah,
that was eerie. Ooh. That was. And then when the last one, he says, I'm sorry, or, you know,
yeah,
whatever
Seymour.
It was. My God. Yeah, that was
Seymour.
Cool.
Yeah.
And it was kind of funny in my house, because my mother was, you know, initially she was a big Hammer person, because, you know, he had Creature Feature and Chiller coming on at certain times and whatever. Exactly.
We're all doing that with our hands.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mark actually has six fingers. Wait a minute. Hold on.
That's a neat trick. But, you know, and I guess, you know, so the thing was, she could handle that. You know, her encounter with The Exorcist, which ended up being my encounter with The Exorcist as well, that was kind of bad, but we kind of worked through it, and I may have just kind of blocked it. And I think I was covering my eyes, first time, you know, I'm six or something. You know, yeah, so I was covering my eyes through enough of that so that I really didn't get the full of it until I was an adult. But I think my mother, outside of reading my stuff, my mother basically signed out of the horror game, basically, like, you know, put her jersey up in the rafters because of Salem's Lot.
Oh.
Salem's Lot, I think, bothered my mother. If I had to kind of pinpoint when we really lost her, you know, it's like between that trip watching Scatman Crothers die and the little Glick boy in Salem's Lot scratching at the glass, yo, I think that was it. I think my mom's was done. It was right there. It was just like, no, with the whole, you know, Ralphie Glick. Yeah, scratching at the glass. It's like, nah, son. It's like, it was a wrap. It was a wrap. She was done.
You know what's messed up about Salem's Lot? That was a movie my father and I watched. And what was messed up, there was that night was they were showing it during the mayoral election. And they kept interrupting the damn movie.
I remember that.
So there's this moment in the movie. They go into the Marsden house. They pull the coffin out. You see, what's his name? Mark is laying by the is it Mark?
It's Mark.
He's laying by the opening, and you see the glowing eyes of the vampires waking up, coming toward him. Mm-hmm. Ben opens the coffin. Barlow opens his eyes. He raises the stake, and just as he's bringing it down, he goes, "We interrupt this program to bring you in." My father and I are like.
Oh man,
I think, like, I heard you make that noise at that time. Yes.
I'm like, there's somebody somewhere in a control booth was like, 3, 2, oh wait, this is gonna be fun, watch this, click. And that progressive yell across New York, and then of course when it came back on, the house was burning, so like we missed like we were just sort of like
the conference, the
right. Yeah, the so that happened, but he did scare me watching that movie. The scene, my father,
your dad did.
He laughed his ass off on this one. It was when they were coming home. They were taking the shortcut, and what's the name? Jumps up with the black bag and covers the Glick boy. Yeah. And they do that, and as soon as he did that, my father turned to me and he goes, "Ah!" And I'm like, and he just starts cracking up. I'm like, "That's not funny, man. Don't you just scare somebody like
that?" Yeah. So it is so funny because I think there were times when my mother was like, "You know, I really shouldn't let him watch," but so much of this stuff. But she worked nights. So I would do what any kid in that situation would do, is I pretend I'm going to bed. Okay, mom, have a nice night at work and blah, 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 blah. And then when that's over, I'm like, click, and I'm watching Kolchak the Night Stalker. And it didn't matter. You know, there was no way to get me busted because my stepfather was a drunk. So he would not literally not hear me watching television. Like, I'd hear him ambling around, muttering to himself or getting dressed to go back to the bar or some old nonsense. Piece of cake. I got through every episode of Kolchak the Night Stalker. Because, you know.
Well, at least you had good taste. At least you had good taste.
Oh, yes, I did.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, I did. And speaking of good taste, Carol Geisander, let the people know your social media situation so they can contact you, so they can buy stuff with your name on it. Just hit us off, please.
Cool. Well, I am easy and difficult all at once. Everything is Carol Geisander. So I have carolgeisander.com. That's me on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram. But Geisander is a really annoying name if you don't see it a lot. It's G-Y. Zander. So I'm used to saying that my whole life, but most people who look at it say, I don't know how to pronounce this. Yeah. But I get over it. Yeah.
All right.
So that's me. That's me. CarolGuyZander.com.
That's amazing. So, Carol, I got to tell you, I'm really grateful that you came on.
This is great conversation. You guys are fun. I've enjoyed listening to the show so many different times. It was fun last week with Denise on. She is just a hoot. She is a gem. Oh. You know, I wanted to put a little flower in my hair just in reference to her. But no, that's her thing, not mine. So
I'm sure she wouldn't mind. I'm sure she wouldn't mind. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's our show tonight. Speaking of drunks, I guess Kirk Johnson kind of did you something like what my stepfather, he has to catch me first. he will join us next week, I'm sure, if only just to cuss me out for making fun of him tonight. Mr. Abbott, as always, it's lovely to see you.
Thank you.
Even though you're literally like four blocks away. I could probably, like, we could hang up now and then I could just go stand in front of Mark's house and annoy him, you know, do the whole get a guitar and do like the old Tom and Jerry thing. Is you ain't my baby. And then his wife will throw something at me.
And speaking of four blocks away in Brooklyn, I'm going to be back in Brooklyn again next month because the rooftop readings at Ample Hills Creamery in Gowanus, Brooklyn is featuring Mr. Stephen Van Patten next month.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Oh, my God.
Mark and I just read this month, you know, and SVP is going to be there the third Tuesday. Yes, that's what it is.
Yeah. And yes, that's right. That's happening.
That's so much fun. Oh, it's so much fun. Yeah, great people, too. Great readings, and the ice cream is fantastic. So
yes, it's going to be a riot. So yes, we've got a lot of stuff happening. I just feel so good right now. Carol, seriously, again, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Mark, obviously I'll be talking to you. And I'm going to be talking to all of you real, real soon because, well, that's kind of what I do. All right. That's it for this episode of Beef Wine and Shenanigans. We're out of here. And fare thee well.